Good evening, and welcome to the presentation of the 2010 William E. Simon Prize for Philanthropic Leadership. My name is James Pearson, and I'm the president of the Simon Foundation. I speak for everyone at the Simon Foundation in saying that we are delighted with our partnership with the Philanthropy Roundtable in the administration of this prize. The late William E. Simon Sr. was one of the founders of the Institute that eventually became the Philanthropy Roundtable. And I know he would be delighted to see how the Roundtable has grown into the formidable organization it is today. I've personally had the privilege of serving on the board of the Roundtable since its founding in 1991, including a stint as chairman for 4 years and as chairman of the Finance Committee. I recall vividly our first conference in 1992 at the Broadmoor in Colorado. And I can assure you that the attendance that day was nowhere near what it is this evening. And we're so delighted with Adam's leadership, his skilled staff, and the tremendous program he puts together year after year. Hats off to you, Adam, and to the entire staff of the Roundtable. Ladies and gentlemen, our prize ceremony will begin after dinner. In the meantime, enjoy your dinner, and we'll be back shortly. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim, and it's a great pleasure to be here tonight. Any occasion honoring Roger Hertog is one that it's an honor for me to be part of. Jim is an old friend, and we're both getting to the stage where we're old friends in both senses of the term, I'm afraid. we'll put that off for a few years. Jim teased you about how Roger was allocating the funds from the award he's getting tonight, and I think I can tell you that maybe he'll say a word or two about it too, that he's distributed them to support the publication of articles in 8 small magazines, the small magazines that Roger knows well and many of you know well, have such a disproportionate influence, I think, on our public life. He's also given funds to Yuval Levin of National Affairs and John Podhoretz of Commentary to publish special selections of essays on domestic and foreign policy within the next 2 years to help shape the important public debate that's going on in domestic and foreign policy. So I think this is a very, as always with Roger, very thoughtful and intelligent use of resources, and I trust they will be, that the recipients of these funds will use them as well as Roger hopes they will. I was actually going to say a little bit about Roger's sort of biography, but actually Brett Stevens' piece in Philanthropy is so excellent that I'll just urge you all to read it and just say a word about my association with Roger. I've known him for almost 2 decades. I served under his chairmanship on the Manhattan Institute board and on the board of the TIKVA Fund. So I've been on the sort of grant receiving end of things with Roger, the think tank end, and then on the grant giving end now at the TIKVA Fund. And we've had many informal collaborations as well. And I would really just very briefly say that Roger's genuinely an unusual philanthropist. It's hard to be a good philanthropist. My father said this 30 years ago, and everyone thought he was joking, but it's actually true. It's very hard to give away money intelligently and effectively and really to make a difference, honestly, in the way that you want to make a difference. Roger combines a willingness to take risks. He often says that one of the puzzling things about philanthropy is that many men and women who've done very well by taking risks in the business world and the private sector, when it comes to giving away money, sort of forget that it's sometimes a good idea to take risks and become awfully conventional and cautious. Roger is a risk taker, but unlike some risk takers who just gamble and double down and don't sort of look at whether the risk is working out, Roger also believes strongly, as he did in the business world at Sanford Bernstein, in analysis and research. So he'll place his bets that he'll analyze if they're working out well, and he'll either double down or triple down sometimes, or he'll he'll, to mix the metaphor slightly, I guess, he'll fold his cards and use resources more wisely the next time. You can't obviously succeed unless you take risks. You can't succeed unless you're willing to fail. And I think Roger it's easy for an outsider like me to say that. I think it's harder to do that when you're either fiduciarily in charge of money or it's your own money and there's a real fear of failure, which is understandable, but I think it hampers sometimes people from being as bold as they might. Roger has a really unusual combination of boldness and prudence, boldness and sort of research and analysis that I personally find to be pretty rare in the philanthropic world, but actually in many different walks of life. People either tend to be bold or cautious, but the combination of sort of intelligent boldness is pretty rare. So I think that's one reason Roger's been such a successful philanthropist, why he's consistently outperformed the philanthropic market, if I can put it that way, just as he outperformed the stock market and the financial markets in his other life. The other thing I would say, though, is that it's not just that he's an intelligent investor and philanthropist, it's that the objects, the topics which he invests, on whose behalf he invests, I think are particularly important. One, I would say, is democratic capitalism, free markets, strengthening our system of economic and political liberty. And that's something that you might expect Roger to have an awful lot of expertise about. And he's been a terrific steward at Emma at Manhattan Institute and on the board of AAI and in many, many other ways has done an awful lot to make the case, but also to deepen the understanding of markets and of democratic capitalism and of the institutions that underlie markets and capitalism. But I'm more struck in a way by Roger's contributions in two other areas. Roger has done an awful lot to deepen and spread the understanding of American history, of the American regime, in ways very public. He's been very much associated with and a major benefactor of the New York Historical Society, but also in ways that are less public and some of which are quite are unknown and, I guess, anonymous. It's great that the Tea Parties have rediscovered the Founding Fathers, but Roger was interested in the Founding Fathers before the Founding Fathers were cool. And really, I would even say that some of the rediscovery of our founding principles and their relevance today is due to work that Roger has directly or indirectly sponsored, but also encouraged, because as with all most good philanthropists, I would say Roger isn't just a benefactor, he's an intellectual partner in the efforts that he backs. So Roger's made a real contribution, I think, to our understanding and the public understanding of this nation that we are fortunate to live in, of our history, of our politics, which is really important and I think a little more difficult, actually, than sort of making the case for free markets or for against excessive government regulation and that sort of thing. Finally, Roger has done a lot, and here I've been on the board with him for the last several years of the TIGFA Fund, has done an awful lot to deepen the understanding, to introduce new people, especially young people, to the Jewish tradition. The focus of TIGFA is Jewish excellence. An awful lot of other very fine philanthropists have done an awful lot for Jewish continuity, to try to make sure that Judaism, this fantastic heritage that some of us are proud to have been born into, doesn't fade away and doesn't sort of just dissipate in the modern world of where things do tend to sometimes fade away and dissipate. Continuity is great, but Roger also strongly believes that this is a tradition, not just that we should keep going because it's been around a long time, but it's a pretty amazing intellectual and spiritual and literary tradition. And Roger has done an awful lot at universities and also outside universities, since maybe you're not aware of this, it's sometimes hard to work with universities, but especially with young people, to really foster the study of and the appreciation of Jewish excellence, to make that a living tradition, not just something you read about when you're a kid maybe and then never think about again. And I think that's a project that's still young, but is really potentially, I think, awfully important. So it's, as I said at the beginning, it really is an honor just to play my little role in this dinner, honoring Roger. He's a very generous man, as so many of you here have been generous, and your families have been so generous with your resources. But I would say what's special about Roger is that he's not just generous in terms of resources, he has a real generosity of spirit that makes him a mentor and a friend to so many of us. And so I would just say in conclusion that it is really an honor to pay tribute to this remarkable colleague and excellent mentor and very good friend. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bill. I should have mentioned that in introducing Bill that I got to know Bill Simon through Bill's father, Irving Kristol, also a dear friend of Roger's. And Irving, like Bill Simon, was a giant in this field of American thought and philanthropy, and appropriate to recognize him as well. Roger Hertog, like Bill Simon, has friends in many fields, and he works in many areas. Tonight we're going to hear from another associate of Roger's, Louise Mirror, distinguished historian in her own right and president and CEO of the New York Historical Society, has made the trip down to Florida for this event, and we're very grateful for Louise for that. Louise?
Thank you so much. I'm also really thrilled and honored to be here and to be among such a distinguished group of philanthropists. And I feel really lucky to be able to congratulate Roger publicly in your midst. So congratulations, Roger. It's just really terrific. Roger's encouraged me not to have recourse in my tribute this evening to the wild hyperbole that so often obscures the real achievements of a worthy man or woman. So I'm going to suppress the urge to credit him with bringing us closer to world peace. Though I really do think I could successfully argue that his philanthropic work has been more relevant to the cause than even some of our Nobel Peace Prize winners. In any... In any event, I promised Roger that I would speak honestly, so I'm going to focus on what I know to be true, and that's Roger's great patriotism and its palpable expression in the transformation that he's inspired at the New York Historical Society, as well as many other institutions of similar kind. Let me begin by making my point by quoting Roger's own words as he spoke before a group of 200 or so new Americans at a naturalization ceremony last year at the New York Historical Society. "I was very moved," Roger said, "when offered the chance to speak today. My parents came to America from Germany. They arrived in 1937 and 1938. I was born here. When my parents became citizens in 1944, I was only 3 years old, and they could speak very little English, and I only spoke German. But somehow they managed to make me know how proud they were, and by the time I was 12 or 13 years old, their English was much better, and they left no question in my mind they were proud to be Americans, and I was blessed to have been born here. The more I've thought about it," he said, "over the years, the more I've understood why they were so proud and I was so lucky. Being an American carries a unique right, the right to belong to one of the very few, if not the only nation in the world, that's built on an idea, not simply a geographical location. Most of us are here, not because we're the descendants of natives of this land, but because those who came before us signed on to a single idea, the idea of liberty, of freedom." I imagine that you're all as drawn into Roger's eloquent expression of our American birthright and its meaning, both personally and collectively, as the 200 new Americans in our auditorium were when he spoke. But I'd all the same bet that even such an eloquent statement of our American birthright as Roger's would, for most people, be more or less part of the rote expression of patriotic fervor, not all that different from what we feel when we sing the national anthem or when we cheer on American athletes in an Olympic game. But nothing about Roger is rote, and certainly not his patriotism. He's strategic, deliberate, moral, and intellectual. And he's set about using those skills, the very same ones that made him so successful in business, no doubt, to promote the American idea through institutions he sees as possibly capable of engaging Americans, especially young Americans, in what our birthright has meant and still means. We've been lucky at the New York Historical Society to be among the many beneficiaries of Roger's talents, his hard work, and his generous gifts. And he's pushed us, really, to figure out ways of making this idea of the power of ideas palpable, along with the people who conceive them. On a personal note, Roger's taught me a lot. To a great extent, he's taught me about running a business, which, of course, even an institution like ours with its lofty goals and ambitions really is. But to the greatest extent, Roger's taught me about generosity, which, of course, is what we're celebrating tonight. And generosity is not just, as the prize that he's been awarded stresses, about money. It's also about leadership and about giving worthy people their due. So I'll close my remarks by giving as generously as I can to Susan Hertog. Though Roger's been quoted as saying, swans, pigeons, and Orthodox Jews mate for life, there's quite a bit more to their long-lived marriage than that. And that's not, of course, to say that Susan's beauty is not swan-like. It is. Susan's been an integral part of Roger's success from the start, and he's really lucky to be the proud husband of such a talented biographer wife. So congratulations again, Roger, and you too, Susan, and thank you very much.
And thanks very much, Louise, for those remarks. Well, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the 2010 winner of the William E. Simon Prize for Philanthropic Leadership, Roger Hertog.
I'm sure you've all heard this story already, but, you know, Lyndon Johnson once was given one of these serial over-the-top introductions, at which point he got up and he thanked all the people and he said, "I only wish my mother and father had been here to hear these things. My daddy would have been very proud, and my mother would have believed it." I'm sure that would be the case. I'm truly honored to be receiving this award in the name of William Simon, a great entrepreneur, a philanthropist, and a very unique individual in his time and who contributed a tremendous amount to the world of ideas and philanthropy. But you've asked me to talk about my own approach to philanthropy, and I must admit I'm a bit uncomfortable talking about myself. Not that I'm so humble, you can ask my wife. Still, I'll do my best given the honor of the Simon Prize. Some of this is a little repetitive, but it has a different slant to it. Most journeys start with a biographical story. In my case, there are two. The first led to political questions and ultimately to a political worldview. The second led to a deep respect for entrepreneurship, free markets, capitalism. Taken together, these two have shaped my views about philanthropy. So let me begin. As you heard, my parents were blessed to come here as refugees from Hitler's Germany in the late 1930s, 3 years before I was born. Neither of them had any skills that were immediately marketable in this country, and they didn't even speak the language. Almost all of the rest of my family, on both sides, were murdered in the Holocaust. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins and all. Aside from parents, I had one relative in this country and one in England. The one thing that concerned me in my early teen years was the fact that the only pictures we had hanging in our single-bedroom apartment in the Bronx, New York, were two discolored newspaper photographs of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I knew, of course, he had been our president, and a great one in many respects. My mother absolutely revered him. But why didn't he allow European Jews to come here? Why didn't he pressure England into letting more Jews into Palestine? Why weren't my parents and teachers more concerned with these questions? I asked, but were never given good answers. That experience made me a skeptic, even as a young adult, about governmental power. Yes, it could be a potent force for good, but it could just as easily fail at critical moments as it did. Over time, this skepticism led to even more fundamental questions about the size and the nature of government. Questions like, how should free people govern themselves? What should government do, and what should it leave to others? What could we learn from government's successes or failures? The second story led to my belief commitment to the ideas of entrepreneurship and capitalism. I needed to work during my years at night college. I got a job in Wall Street, a small job, but one that gave me enough of a glimpse into the business world. My interest intensified at 27 years old. I became part of a small group that helped a young investment research and management firm, Sanford C. Bernstein & Company, get on its feet, grow. Participating in building that firm taught me not only how incredibly difficult it is to start an enterprise from scratch, it meant navigating the most complex environments with a small group of partners, usually with no map. The ups and downs, as any of you who have done this, were frustrating. But on balance, there were more ups than downs. The experience about being part of a firm that started with 13 people and 30 years later had 1,000 imbued me with the deepest kind of respect for what entrepreneurs in the capitalist system could accomplish. Now, in my early 20s, if you had asked me about my priorities, in truth, I would have said three things. It's sort of embarrassing when you say them today, but they're true. My first priority was making money. The second was meeting girls. That's what we called them in those days. And a distant third was the world of ideas. By the time I was 25, I had checked off one of them. I married a terrific young woman, still my bride after 45 years of marriage, 3 grown children, and 3 grandchildren. Twenty years later, the success of the Bernstein firm had also made me confident on the score of financial security. Not that I still didn't have to work, but at that point, two of my children were already in college, and I could concentrate some of my energies on the third priority, ideas. I spent a lot of time reading small journals, in essence learning how to think. Journals like Commentary in the Public Interest. I tried to deepen my understanding of American history, the governing and political and economic principles of America and the West, of the existential challenges facing Israel and the Jewish people, and the great figures of the past who helped shape the future. At age 68, in the final chapter of my life, my full-time occupation is investing in the world of ideas. It's hard work, requiring much the same creativity, judgment, and strategic sense that are necessary in business. Philanthropy of this kind and others is very similar to the world of business. My governing purpose is to find, support, and hopefully influence the next generation of leaders, be it in politics, the academy, history, religion, national security. Two foundations are the means to my philanthropic ends. One is the Tikva Fund. Tikva means hope in Hebrew, which was funded by my partner Zalman Bernstein and focuses on bringing the richness of Jewish ideas to the very best young minds. The second is the Hertog Foundation, whose purpose is to bring the very best ideas in defense of Western civilization, especially political and economic thought, to once again young people, the very best young people. While the two foundations have really different purposes, they follow similar strategies. Chiefly, they try to invest in people. Everything starts with people who are conceiving the best ideas in the institutions that transmit them and in the young minds that are receiving them. Both foundations have a couple of common tenets. To begin with, there's the importance of a sunset clause. We've set approximately 20 years, a time horizon by which our money should be given away. The second tenet is a hesitancy to fund endowments. I'm suspicious of support where once the check is cashed, the donor has little, if any, influence except going to very nice dinners. Finally, there's a willingness to speculate, which Bill mentioned. Excuse me. To take chances of making a mistake. There's an irony that most entrepreneurs make their money by taking risks. The only people who make any serious money have at some point or another taken risks, betting upon what they believe in, even though at times they may be wrong. Then when we or they become philanthropists, they forget what sparked that success in the first place. They become too risk-averse. My greatest worry is, however, that conservatives, like me, haven't invested enough time, energy, and treasure in the many spaces where young minds and even more mature adults are influenced. History teaches that political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, have more impact on the way the world goes than is commonly believed. Over time, the world is often shaped by the greatest thoughts or the most destructive theories of the most powerful minds. But even the greatest minds begin as young people. They need mentors. They need teachers. They need to be introduced to the bodies of thought and the world of ideas that might enable them to become great thinkers themselves. All of us know this in our own way. We've had some teacher, some course that helped shape our lives. Education. The job of education of the young should reside and should be thought of in this way, and it should be done at the universities. Every single year, the smartest young men and women, those who are assuredly will be the leaders of the next generation, are to be found at the top 100 campuses around the country. Just think of it. We send our kids to these top 100 places, and we hope and pray they get into these places. One only needs to check where our congressmen, senators, Supreme Court justices, cabinet members, business and religious leaders have studied or taught. Then you recognize why universities are so important. The teachers at those places are the arbiters, maybe not the final arbiters, of what our children learn and believe. If their teaching is one-sided, in either direction, it takes tremendous disservice to these young men and women. Unless we populate the humanities with an alternative to the ascendant ideology, conservative ideas about limited government, rule of law, individual liberty, and the role of religion will over time lose out, as it has in many great campuses around the country. This doesn't mean we should indulge in indoctrination. That shouldn't be necessary. If we can simply get our ideas on the table, we'll win our fair share of minds. But universities are only one piece of the puzzle. There are also opportunities to fund or even originate summer programs, not necessarily university-based, where the best students can be brought together with the very best faculty in the country. The advantage is here that you, the donor, can play a role in choosing the students, the faculty, and influencing the curriculum. By way of example, let me mention the Hertog program in political thought. There are others, but this is one that I know something about, which just completed its first summer session in Washington, D.C. 160 of the very best candidates in the country from 65 universities vie for 20 seats this program had to offer. The group spent 7 weeks on site devoting their mornings to studying political theory in depth, being Aristotle or the Federalist Papers or Machiavelli and the Bible. The afternoons were devoted to lengthy meetings with real-world practitioners like Henry Kissinger, Charles Krauthammer, David Brooks, General Jack Keane, and many others. If educational programs are the essential long-term investment, think tanks, small magazines, books, freestanding institutions are the best middle-term investment, especially if the aim is to disseminate ideas. There are many good think tanks and magazines around the country, both to the left or the right of center. They don't usually have much overhead, and they're all about ideas. One of the best is the Manhattan Institute, who actually helped reshape New York City during the 8 years of Rudy Giuliani's era. It was their scholars who came up with the new conception of policing that did so much to create safe streets in New York. It was they who pioneered new welfare-to-work systems and key innovations in public school systems, K-12, and the City University. Imagine what a high return on investment in that kind of institution was, when it meant helping to turn around the largest, most powerful city in the country, if not the world, a city that was considered just 5 or 6 or 7 years ago before that era, ungovernable. One of the nation's truly premier think tanks is the 30-year-old plus American Enterprise Institute in Washington. There are 60 scholars on this roster with a remarkable set of achievements over 25 years. Just for the moment, step back and contemplate the power of ideas. Their most recent success was achieved by the military historian and strategist Fred Kagan. During the period of the war in Iraq, Kagan and his team came up with the idea of the surge. By 2006, everyone, whether you were for or against the war, knew that a new strategy was desperately needed. But it was a small group, a tiny group, of thinkers at AEI that developed the strategy and ultimately sold it to the White House. It changed policy, turned around the war that had seemed hopeless just months before. Ideas have consequences. They're very valuable to invest in. There's also been a long tradition in this country of extremely influential small magazines. Magazines without a lot of circulation. They just have the right people reading them. Because a magazine has a large circulation, it doesn't mean it is necessarily influential. One of the very best is Commentary, which in the post-war era has been in the middle of the debate, and I would argue winning the debate, on the largest questions facing our nation regarding national security, foreign policy, cultural issues, and the U.S. support for Israel. A number of us started a new magazine this year in D.C. called National Affairs, concentrating on the domestic side of the agenda. Why? Because you need new ideas to change the way we're running our budget, taxes, all of the big questions. It comes out quarterly. It links often unknown scholars who are writing soberly and persuasively about our nation's largest social policy issues, such as public sector unions, school choice, the future of the welfare state, and the racial achievement gap. There are other kinds of institutions as well that can have an important impact on big issues. As Louise mentioned, I'm involved with the New York Historical Society, an important institution with a national mission. It is the purpose to help people of all ages, including the very youngest, see and understand the great stories of American history and their birthright. Sadly, public schools and many private ones no longer spend much time teaching the Constitution, the Revolutionary War, why we fought the Civil War, why it was noble, what was the basis of World War II. The Historical Society is helping to fill the gap, not just in New York, but around the country. Why is it important? Because history matters. Because it would be a tragedy if 20 or 30 years ago now, for our grandchildren, if they really didn't understand what was the basis of the American founding. In our audience is Jack Miller, who's done an enormous amount of work on this, and his foundation has really been a leader in this. But there are other important challenges in public education. It is sad but true that bad ideas hurt the most disadvantaged members of our society the most. and better ideas are often their best and only hope. As things stand, inner city children are forced to begin life for a whole host of reasons with unfair disadvantages. They never get to understand the exceptional nature of this country, the history of the free market, what has been accomplished, and perhaps most important, what they themselves can accomplish. Charter schools are in essence about competition, but they're also about ideas. These young men and women have to understand what makes America great. If they do that, they exemplify what this country is all about. Let me close by saying something about my interest in Judaism and in the future of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. I have come to understand so much of who I am and what I believe about politics and about life that is connected to religion, in my case, the Jewish religion. Whether stronger political leadership in the 30s might have prevented the Shoah, we'll never know. But what seems self-evident is that strong political leadership will be needed in the days ahead if the Jewish people are to survive. And what I have come to appreciate in the gradual return to my tradition is that the Jewish people and the Jewish way of life are indeed worthy of survival, that many of the great moral ideas of the West have Hebraic roots, that the Jewish tradition and the Jewish state are reservoirs of wisdom and beacons of hope that matter to all lovers of civilization and democracy, Jews and non-Jews alike. Finally, I have no delusions of grandeur. Many well-intended philanthropic efforts amount to nothing or worse. And sometimes the best we can do is to make a difference on the margin. We should hope for more, but we might not do more than that. But occasionally, and in ways that I may not see in my lifetime, the right investments in people and ideas could really matter. Intellectual depth, political realism, largeness of soul. These are things that can never be taken for granted. And Americans who are first and foremost care about the future of this republic must rededicate themselves to these noble purposes. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for this honor.
Roger, thanks very much for that. We pray you succeed. We're so honored that you've accepted this award. Godspeed to you and Susan, and congratulations again. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our proceedings for this evening. Thank you very much.